So that's good. There it comes. Last time we were talking about geography, topography, and ecology. How do these things shape architectural environments at a larger scale primarily? There also are implications on buildings, and we talked a bit about that, but primarily thinking about how at a planning scale, how does environmental planning shape buildings, neighborhoods, communities? And we looked at three examples, one that had gone horribly bad, terrible, terrible problems created by ignoring simple physical considerations that could have been taken care of, but were not taken care of. And then we looked at two instances where just by paying attention to those issues, horrible problems were avoided. And in fact, very beautiful environments were created, like at Sea Ranch, where nature won, ecologically, very sensitive, also just visually very sensitive. So I asked in the Twitter card question, how important do you think this is? Are these issues like a 10 on a scale of 1 to 10? Are they a 5? Are they a 2? How do you feel about it? And I was really impressed, probably the great majority of people put 10, but there were other points of view too, so let me read you a few of these. Someone says, 10, I honestly don't see how it can be ignored or seen as anything less than crucial. Paying attention to these issues doesn't necessitate ugly architecture. In fact, it often enhances the beauty of a place. A great architectural development should understand its place in the landscape, honor the environment, and then make it harmonious and a beautiful whole. Someone else says, 10. I decided I wanted to transfer into architectural engineering because of how much environmental stability means to me. It is efficient, less destructive to our planet, and more beautiful than any concrete jungle could ever be. When I settle in a town, its environmental integrity will be very important to me. Somebody else says, 10. These values are of the utmost importance. They're not boring to me because they involve solving puzzles that have tangible, real solutions. Architecture in an aesthetic sense requires more creativity and has an indeterminate solution. But environmental planning involves solving real problems. Architecture cannot advance without environmental planning. Someone else says, 9. It is extremely important for architecture to harmonize with the environment. Despite the power of humans to change the earth, we are still powerless to the natural forces of this planet. The only way to build a home without being destroyed in the future is to obey the laws of nature. Someone else says, 8. Nature has already created the perfect equilibrium over millions of years of evolution, so architects should do as much as possible not to alter that balance. Not only will the environment reward them, but the structure will then be at peace with nature and fit into its surroundings. Someone else says, I feel like this concept is 6 out of 10. The environmental planning of a city is important, but it seems as if we would be eliminating some things that are also important, like social aspects of a community, parking lots, shopping centers, etc. So, yes, it's important to preserve what we can, but ultimately, it should not be done everywhere. Someone else says, to me, these are about a 5 on a scale of 1 to 10. What I really admire about architecture is the overall aesthetic. I like jaw-dropping moments when I see architecture that leaves me speechless. I know these things are necessary for the function of architecture, but they just don't excite me at all, like the aesthetic qualities of architecture. That's good. Good range of responses on that. I want to make the point that what we were talking about last time, we often kind of think of these things as, oh, that was a natural disaster. Oh, Katrina was a natural disaster. Oh, Hurricane Ike was a natural disaster. And yes, it was a hurricane, okay? They're hurricanes. But honestly, hurricanes, they're a part of nature. They've been around forever. And you can either build in such a way that it avoids problems when there is a natural occurrence like that, or not. And I would say that a lot of the destruction that we talk about coming out of a natural disaster is actually a man-made disaster. We did that. We built in such a way that it made us vulnerable to weather occurrences like that. And as we looked at in the case of the Woodlands, it's not that hard to design in such a way that it pays attention to those issues and avoids disaster. So the last two lectures have been dealing with physical considerations kind of from the outside in. What are these physical forces that we see in nature and in ecology and in geography and topography that affect a building from the outside? Today we're going to be looking more inside out. What are the actual physical considerations of the building itself, the pieces and parts and elements that a building is made of, and how are physical considerations at work there? And to really talk about this, we need to have a very basic understanding of a segment of physics called statics and dynamics. And some of you are engineering students, and gosh, you know what statics and dynamics are, and their whole course is taught on that, and we're not going to go that far. And then there's some of you that are like English majors or something, and statics and dynamics is not exactly your cup of tea. But we're going to just seek a very basic understanding here. So you engineering students are going to think I'm talking baby talk up here, and maybe the English majors will think, oh my goodness, that's so over my head. So we're going to try to find some common ground here on a little bit of physics. So there are four kinds of forces that act on buildings. Four kinds of forces. The first is tension. And this is where something is making an element of the building, a piece of the building, stretch. And if you stretch it enough, then the molecular bonds of the material that it's made out of begin to disintegrate, and you get failure in the building. So tension is stretching apart. The second force that occurs in buildings is compression. That's where things get smashed together. And again, if there's a sufficient force of compression, the molecular bonds of a material may actually start to disintegrate, and you get failure in the building again. So smashing together or compression is the second force. The third force is bending. And bending is actually a combination of tension and compression. So imagine that I've got a piece of wood here, and I take it and crack it over my knee like this. I bend it until it breaks. What's actually happening when you bend something is that the top of it is in tension. It's pulling apart. And the bottom of that piece is in compression. It's smashing together. So bending, breaking something and bending, is a combination of tension and compression. And that's a third force that we look at in buildings, bending. The fourth force is shear. And shear is if I took that same piece of wood and I just pulled it apart like that and sheared it across a line in that. That lateral force across a material is called shear. And that's the fourth force that we look at in buildings. So it's tension, compression, bending, and shear. Now, the truth is, although there is tension in buildings, and sometimes there's pure tension, and occasionally a building will fail in tension, that's pretty rare. Something like a tent is a tension structure. So when you set up your tent, and you've got the fabric like that, you've got all those guy wires going out, and you peg them into the ground, and then a wind comes along, and it pushes against that fabric. When it's billowing that fabric like that, that fabric is in tension. It's stretching that fabric, and if it fails, it will rip, and those molecular bonds will break in tension. Likewise, that cable that goes down to the ground, when the wind comes along and it stretches that cable and it finally pops, that's failure in tension. So something like a tent, yes, tension is the controlling factor in a tent generally. So that's important. But how many of us live in tents? Not many. How many office buildings are tents? Not many. So this is a relatively small quantity of architecture that really is primarily concerned with tension. So I want to acknowledge tension's there, but we're going to kind of put it on the back burner today. Likewise, shear is an important force in a few buildings. So in an earthquake-prone area, what happens in an earthquake is the ground starts going, bum, 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 and the building wants to stay like this. And so what gets destroyed is generally in shear. The buildings get sheared. They're sitting on the ground like this. The ground moves back and forth like that, and it creates forces of shear. So when we do earthquake design, we're very concerned about shear. And in California, they have to be very concerned about shear. Also, sometimes tall buildings where they're tethered to the ground down here and they have wind forces that go on them like this, that's creating a force of shear where the building hits the ground. The wind wants it to move this way. The ground wants it to stay there, and we have forces of shear there. So sometimes in high-rise buildings, they're designed for shear. But again, this is the minority of buildings, so we're going to kind of put shear on the back burner today, too. That leaves bending and compression. And most buildings that we look at, that we design, we're designing for compression or for bending. So that's what we're going to kind of concentrate on today. And we're going to think first about compression or bearing structures, and then we're going to think about bending or frame structures. So you can imagine compressive structures, just the simplest thing in the world. If you go out in a pasture and you pick up all the rocks and you stack the rocks on top of each other and you make a rock wall, that wall is in compression. All of gravity is pushing all of those forces down, and those forces are collecting from the top of the wall more and more and more and more and more force until it gets to the bottom of the wall where it isn't going into the ground. And even the forces that are acting on the ground are compressive forces for the ground. So we're looking for materials that would resist those forces. So what are materials that are good in compression? So rock, stone, that's very good in compression. And that's just by the nature of its molecular bonds. The way the molecules are constructed, they resist compression very well. So stone is very, very good in compression. Other kinds of things similar to stone, like brick, that would be good in compression. Concrete, that would be good in compression. These kind of earthen materials, like the ground actually is very good in compression. So all of those are, because of their molecular bonds, they're very good in compression. And so we tend to use them in compressive structures. Now, very different when we're looking at bending structures. Now we have to have a combination of tension and compression. Something like concrete, it's very good in compression, but it's terrible in tension. Something like a brick, very good in compression, but terrible in tension. Stone, good in compression, but terrible in tension. That means if you take a brick, you know, one of those brick with holes in it, and let's say you put a wire in the hole on either side, and you tie one to, car bumper, and you tie another to somebody else's car bumper, and the cars start pulling like that, man, that thing will snap, because that's tension, and that brick's not going to be good in tension, it'll snap like crazy. You take that same car or truck, you put that brick on the ground, and you roll over it, you smash it, excellent, that brick will be just fine. So it's good in tension, it's good in compression, it's not good in tension. So because bending is a combination of tension and compression, it's not good in bending as well. Now, what is good in bending? So if we want to make a frame structure, columns, beams that might be in bending, what would be good? We're looking for materials that are kind of equally good in tension and compression. So wood, it turns out, because of its molecular bonds, it's about equally good in tension and compression. That makes it good in bending. So if we want to make a beam that spans between two things, wood's pretty good at that. Something like steel is excellent in tension and excellent in compression. Super, super capable material like steel. But because it's equally good in tension and compression, that makes it very good in bending. So again, you want to make even a much more capable beam that would resist bending, then steel would be an excellent material. Now, another interesting material in this regard is reinforced concrete. And most concrete you see out there is not just concrete, it's reinforced concrete. Concrete, by the way, it's a man-made material that is made out of cement and small aggregate or sand, large aggregate or rocks, and water. And basically, you mix up those four things and it hydrates and it becomes stone-like, it becomes concrete. But reinforced concrete is not only those materials, but we put reinforcing bars in there, rebars, that are made out of steel. And the thing you do in reinforced concrete is, let's say we make a reinforced concrete beam, we would put the reinforcing bars at the bottom, that would resist the tension that's happening there, and we would use the capability of the concrete at the top to resist the compression. And the combination of the steel in tension and the concrete in compression makes a very, very good member to resist bending. So, what we're doing in designing a building is for figuring out what are the forces that are at work here, what are the quantities of those forces, what are the materials that resist the kind of force that we're seeing in the building. And what is the quantity of material to resist the quantity of force that's in that building? It's very simple. That's how you design the structural frame or the structural bones of a building. So let's look at a few examples of how that works. And we're going to start with compressive structures. The first example is a super ancient city, the city of Hattusis. And Hattusis is in the center of Turkey, actually a very, very remote, very interesting part of the world. Hattusis was a Hittite city, and way back in, it was founded about 6,000 BC. It was abandoned pretty much in 1200 BC, in a period about the middle of there. It was one of the largest cities in the world. It had about 50,000 people in it. And it was kind of the capital of the Hittite Empire. So this is an ancient, ancient city. And we're seeing how this rather sophisticated culture, we're seeing how it's developing the technology of building. So there in this region, as you can see, there's hardly any trees around here in central Turkey, but there are tons and tons of rocks. There's lots of stone. Mountains are made out of these rocks. So the Hittites got to be very good at quarrying that stone, taking the rock out of the ground, and shaping it to make their buildings. And now, because the material they have to work with is stone, they're looking for making compressive structures. That's the capability they have, is a material that's good in compression. So how do we make compressive structures? And you can see all of these foundations that they laid for their buildings, big, thick stone foundations. They're really very good at this. You can see how they're shaping that stone. That's a threshold that goes into the house from inside to outside. The way they connect the stones is not so much by mortar, but by pegging them together. So you see those holes like that? They would have found a very dense material, a denser kind of stone, and they would have made a cylinder out of that. And then they would rub that together, and they would put some grit on the rock, and they would drill. It would take a long time, but they would drill these holes in the rock. And then they would stack two rocks on top of each other with the holes aligned, and they would put a stone peg in that, and that's how they would link the stones together. Super laborious. It took thousands of hours to make one of these buildings out of that. But the result of that would be these beautifully dressed stone walls where you could hardly put a knife between those joints. No mortar in them, but just pegged joints that would link all the stones together. And then the forces of gravity are pushing down on this, and they're collecting and they're building big, strong, capable walls. And that's what Hattusius was made out of. So they then they didn't have very much material like wood. It was very precious. They would use it to stand across and make the roof. But because it was so rare, they really, really wanted to find a way to use the stone to make a room, not just a wall, but to make a room. And so you see them trying to span the stone over and make it in bending. And in both of these cases, the stone is trying to perform in bending, but you can see, whoa, dude, they have to have a big-ass stone to try to do that. And they're slowly corbeling out a little bit and a little bit, and then trying to make that span just as small as it can be, because stone does not want to be in bending. It wants to be in compression, and so they know it's going to break if we don't make a huge, even to do a relatively small span. And then you see all kinds of places where it failed. That was a gate to the city. They were spanning across with a stone, and because stone's not good in bending, so over time, what failed? The stone in bending. All the stone that's in compression on the sides, perfectly intact, looks great. It performs wonderfully. Now, the interesting thing is seeing the Hittites trying to make space totally in compression. They know how to make a wall that makes those gravity loads collecting compression down to the ground. And they can use that abundant material they have, that stone, to do it. And then they're trying to figure out a way, well, if we corbel it out a bit and a bit and a bit, and then we just have the tiniest little span at the top, we can make a room totally in compression, except for that little bitty bit up there, and we could use a really badass big stone to do that. But unfortunately, that room is about my arm span. I could touch both walls inside this room. So it's not much of a room, you know. They're limited by the material and by the technology that material is capable of. Then this is, you know, long before Christ, 1,200 years before Christ. Finally, later, we have the Romans come along, and the Romans figured out how to use that same stone material, keep it in compression, but have it span, have it go from one place to another and make an opening. So this is the Pont du Gard, which is a bridge
that the Romans built in the southern part of France. This was 14 AD, right after Christ. And you see the roadway going here. It also was an aqueduct that carried water from one mountain range over here over to the other over there. This enormous, magnificent piece of structure, all made out of stone and all in compression. But what the Romans realized is if you make a perfect segment of a circle, it carries those loads evenly in compression around to the sides like that. And that's something as fantastic as the Incas were as builders in the Americas, as fantastic as the Hittites were in ancient Turkey. Neither of them ever discovered the arch. And when the Romans came along, they discovered the arch, and they made these magnificent compressive structures where the loads are carried evenly. You can see how there are little arches at the top and a relatively thin wall. As the loads collect, you get bigger arches, thicker walls. As they collect, you get not quite so tall an arch and a thicker wall still, and you're just feeling the greater collection of loads creating a greater necessity for stone to resist that compression. Now, we can look at something like many, many Roman buildings, but in this case, the Colosseum in Rome, and we can see what they're really making the architecture out of is technology. It's just arches that are using that stone in compression in the very most sensible way to transfer those loads around, allowing them to get openings so that they can move the people in at the bottom to their big games at the Colosseum so they can get light in at the top. And all of that is possible because of this technology, the arch that they invented. And it actually is, as you see the ruins now of the Colosseum, you can see where this technology fails. If you take out the keystone at the top of an arch, it is no longer structurally sound. It depends on the completion of that geometry to carry the loads around. So take out that middle piece and everything falls down, as that fall did right here. So actually, Colosseum's a fantastic place to go and look at exactly how a compressive structure behaves. Now, people come from all over the world to see the Colosseum and to see other Roman buildings. And many people find them to be incredibly beautiful. Something like the Colosseum, beautiful rhythms, beautiful shapes, beautiful use of materials. But the interesting thing to me is this was not done to be beautiful. This was done because it's technology. Because it's really just the way you build in stone in a very sensible way. And that's interesting to me. Is there some kind of connection between, as we talked about before, technology and beauty? And in fact, do we find the Colosseum more beautiful because it is this elegant, really kind of lean and mean technological advancement and technological application? And is that something that contributes to its beauty? So I wonder if we just get a few comments here. If I told you that this whole thing was made out of silly putty and that it had this plaster scrim on the top of it, and that in fact there was a steel frame inside that and it wasn't structural at all, would it reduce its beauty? Is there something that makes it more powerful, more elegant, more beautiful by the fact that it is authentic? What do you think? Or is beauty separate from technology? What do you think? Good.
I think the fact that it's so structurally sound that it's survived all of these years is definitely something that contributes to its beauty. And it's still, there are places where the technology is broken down, but for the most part, it's in impeccable condition, and I think that's super admirable.
So there's something we kind of like about ruins, about seeing these things that just seem, wow, they stood the test of time. And it is its technology that's very clearly making it stand the test of time. Other people, is this more beautiful because it's tied to an elegant structural solution? Or would you just assume it be scenographic? Come on, guys, what do you think? Is it more beautiful? Yeah. So what do you think?
I think that when you first see it and you like perceive it as beautiful, the reason is probably not consciously, at least, because of the technology. You might realize it like subconsciously, just like you were saying, because it's a ruin and it's been there for so long. But it's kind of something that once you know more about it, I think you can see it as almost more beautiful. So it just like enhances the beauty.
That's cool. Maybe there's a level at which it's almost visceral. Like we can feel the structural stability of our body. We understand how gravity works on our body. And in some ways, we can unconsciously transfer that to seeing that building working that way. But it's probably purely unconscious. But then there's the more conscious thing of then understanding how compression works. And maybe that, in fact, enhances the beauty of the building. So this is in kind of two dimensions, making a wall. Let's look how the Romans dealt with that issue of how do you make a space in compression. And because they discovered the arch, then it was very natural to then make it into a vault, an extruded arch, a vault, or to make it into a dome, which is a double curvature, and uses that same circular and now spherical shape to make the structure work better. So in this case, this is the Pantheon in Rome, a very important Roman building built by Hadrian, who was the emperor of Rome in this period, 120 to 124 AD. And this is probably the most famous Roman building. If you go to Rome and you're doing the sort of ancient Rome tour, you're absolutely going to go to the Pantheon. It's a classic building, and it's this enormous space, 120 feet across, and it has this oculus at the top. Of course, in the center, there's no loads right there. And then slowly, slowly, the loads are collected here, and you can see it's thin at the beginning, and it gets thicker and thicker and thicker and thicker until it's these massive 20-foot-thick walls of masonry that carry the loads down to the ground. And it again is this perfect structure. And even within that, there are like arches that you want to have a little niche open up at the bottom down here. Well, you open it up early on and then you reiterate again with another arch carrying those loads around. And then you have little colonnettes here, but even those have arches above them to make those loads in a very smooth, even way, carry the gravity loads around and down into the solid masonry in compression and finally down into the ground. And you can see the scale. God, it's enormous, this huge space there. It's a very interesting etching from a period when the skin was off of the Pantheon because it had an exterior skin on it, but that had deteriorated and you could see what it was made of inside. And it actually is these series of arches that are, and the materials here are stone and brick and rubble concrete, all of these compressive materials that are being used together to create this domed space. So that, at the time, was a total blow away. 120 feet, I mean, the Hittites were trying like crazy to just get a room. And now they've got this magnificent, you know, church that's made out of compressive loads totally, this huge stone artifact. This was an enormous advance in technology. But that kind of paled to a couple of hundred years later when Constantine changed the capital of the Roman Empire from Rome to Constantinople, what now is Istanbul. And when he made that change, he began to build these magnificent new buildings. 400 years later, technology had advanced. And he's building now what is meant to be the most amazing and magnificent church structure at that point. And it's now Hagia Sophia. It's a mosque, but originally was a Christian church. So he's got the dome that we can see from the Pantheon. But in addition, there are semi-domes on either side, half a dome, again, carrying that load around and in compression, but then opening it up and carrying it further out in compression. And then at the bottom of that semi-dome, there are three other semi-domes. So you're using a series of these domes to carry the load just as far out and to make the very biggest space in the center you possibly can. And that means that at the edges, you've got these massive buttresses made out of masonry that are all in compression, finally carrying those loads down into the ground at the edge. And around the sides, there are these vaulted spaces, sometimes a simple vault like that, sometimes what we call a groin vault, which is vaulted in four directions. All of those, again, a way to take those loads around and down at the edge of the building. So in the center, we have the big dome. On either side, we have a semi-dome like that. On this side of the semi-dome, we have three other semi-domes. So now we're making this almost football field-long space in the center that's completely open, and the compressive loads are being carried down at the perimeter all the way around. And inside this mind-blowing, beautiful, beautiful space, and where you want to let light in, you have to make little arches, little tiny arches, and let the loads carry on either side of them down. But with the combination of all those tiny arches, you can get a fair amount of light into the space. So the major dome, the semi-dome to the side, the semi-domes besides that, and this big unobstructed space down below that was able to achieve through that technology. So again, it's understanding the materials, understanding the forces, understanding how they're applied, the quantities, the shapes they need to be to perform at their maximum, and that's shaping the architecture. So we can look at this and say, damn, that is a badass good-looking building. That's awesome. But what they're really dealing with here is technology. They're understanding how can we use this material we have, this stone, to the largest space inside we possibly can make. How can we stretch that to the nth degree? Now, that happens at the scale of these magnificent buildings. But it also happens at the scale of more ordinary buildings. We're going to look at a couple of buildings in northeastern Massachusetts, just outside of Boston. And they're buildings by H.H. Richardson, very famous American architect in the 19th century. And he's using masonry materials. And now, in part, he's using them structurally as technology. But he's going a little further than that. He's actually saying, I'm going to take that technology and I'm going to express it. I'm going to show you what compression is about. I'm going to make this stone wall feel like it's heavy and solid and massive. So he's taking these stones, which are Roxbury pudding stone that he found in the area, and he's making this wall in such a way that it feels big and heavy and strong. And that each stone seems like it's being squished and it's being pushed out like the Pillsbury Doughboy, because that load on it is so forceful, it wants to puff it out. And every detail of the building, you see the voussures, that keystone, the very important part of the arch there, as emphasized and letting you understand how important it is in making that arch. Occasionally, he'll use a stone in bending that is not arched, and then he makes it a huge, fat stone, so you understand how big a job that's doing, how it's doing more than it really wants to do. And then this big, this is a gatehouse. It's the entry portal to a whole estate. And that big arch for the carriage to go through, that becomes a major feature with these big dressed voisures. So he's basically saying, what I'm going to make the architecture out of is expressing what this structure is. In rubble stones, these fat, puffy stones, in the way I make an arch, in the way I make a standing lintel, all of these, I'm going to make that the expression of the architecture. And it makes very cool building. This is always, I don't know, when I was in college, I went out and saw this building. Boy, I love that building. It's just something kind of really strong and authentic and real about the way it's put together. Just a little way away, same architect, Edgeridge Richardson, did the town hall in northeastern Massachusetts. And this is one where that Roxbury pudding stone, that same stone he used in the gatehouse, there are outcroppings of that all over town. And so right here, kind of the tallest point in town, there's a big outcropping of Roxbury pudding stone. And then he's just putting the building on top of that. So just as massive and strong as that is, then he's making a massive set of retaining walls and steps. And then they're going up to a very massive base of the building there, the outcropping base. And then the bottom of the building has these big, massive, again, arches that you feel the weight of it. Just the proportions of this, it almost feels like it's squashing down that little colonnette there that's holding the arch and carrying the load down into the ground. You see the expression of the base where that begins to distribute the load into the ground. You see the expression of the capital where the load is being collected and taken down into the base. Every articulation in the building is talking about forces and loads and transfers and compression. And the composite of that is the same, heavy, heavy solid at the bottom as it gets transferred in the ground. Then these big arches that let you feel the weight of the building. Then as the building goes higher, it gets lighter. Now we don't need stone anymore. We can go with a less robust material like brick. And then finally, at the top, we can even make a wood frame that makes the roof of the building. So it slowly gets heavier and heavier as the loads collect and it goes down into the ground. Again, the architecture is being made out of a really thorough understanding of structure and materials. And then just to see a more contemporary version of this, a couple of examples here. This is Le Corbusier, an old friend. We've looked at many buildings by Le Corbusier. In this case, he's doing a little kind of duplex house in Neuilly, a suburb of Paris, for two brothers, the Jaoul brothers. And so we have two Maisons Jaoul, one perpendicular to the other. And the Maisons Jaoul are really made out of a series of three walls, one wall, two walls, three walls. The other one is one wall, two walls, three walls. So parallel walls. And those walls are made out of brick, the masonry walls. They're carrying the loads down into the ground. Between those walls, there are vaults like that that are carrying the roof loads down into those walls and into the ground. And from the outside, it's very clear the heavy masonry walls in compression. The vaults carrying the loads in compression around to that. Inside, we see those same shapes. But instead of this being a perfect half circle, which carries the loads evenly down into the ground, we have a segment of a circle. So it's carrying those loads evenly along here, but when it hits the wall, they're still thrust out. It still wants to push out because it hasn't resolved itself down to vertical yet. So what's happening here is that he's compensating for that by these steel bars. See that steel bar across there? So that steel bar is in tension and it's holding the two walls together. So as the vault thrusts out, the steel holds it together in tension. And you can see what a little bit of steel it takes, because steel is so strong, to compensate for those thrusting out loads from the roof above. So again, he's making very, very explicit the forces in the building, and those become the major architectural expression, just as we were seeing in Judge Richardson's work. There are more shots of the Ozone Joe. You know, again, you're looking at that and you think, God, those are beautiful vaults. I'd love to have a house that had those nice tile vaults like that. But it's not cosmetic. It's not aesthetic. That vault is there because that's the structural frame of the house. Another contemporary, or more contemporary, 20th century example, this is Morrison Stiles College. It's dormitories at Yale, done by Errol Sernin. Again, Errol Sernin's an architect we've looked at. We saw the TDBA terminal he did earlier. Very famous 20th century architect. And in this case, he's working on a campus that has a lot of masonry buildings, older masonry buildings like that. That's actually the gymnasium at Yale. And it's this brick neo-Gothic building. And you see those heavy walls and the thick piers and the vertical windows. Everything's carrying the loads right straight down into the ground like a Gothic cathedral does. And these buildings are all over on the campus because Yale is kind of a neo-Gothic campus. So he's building this contemporary dorm, but he's using those same structural principles, that there are piers made out of masonry. And in this case, he's making them out of a very interesting kind of concrete. I said that concrete's made of cement and large aggregate and small aggregate and water. In this case, his large aggregate, instead of being rocks, which are usually an inch or two in diameter, now he's making rocks that are 8 or 10 inches in diameter. And he's putting these chunky rocks into the formwork first, and then he's building around those the concrete. He's pouring then the cement and the small aggregate and the water mix, and then they're kind of washing it off so that you begin to see the larger aggregate show in the face of the building. So it makes quite a beautiful masonry wall. But again, it is using those masonry walls in compression. When he makes a window, he simply stops the wall and lets the glass stack as a window there. But we're seeing all the walls very much in compression. Now, because dormitories need big spaces, we're not seeing dramatic arches or vaults or anything like that. But we're seeing just this series of masonry walls that make the dormitory at Yale. Okay, all of that is compressive structures. And the point is to understand how the forces and the materials and the loads and the quantities of force and the quantity of material required all begin to shape the architectural character of the building. The second kind of architectural expression that we want to talk about, and the second kind of architectural load that we're talking about, is bending. And we're going to look at now a whole series of bending structures. And generally that means they take the form of a frame. So you have columns and you have beams. And when you put a load on a column, it's standing like this. And if the load gets heavier and heavier and heavier, what that column wants to do is bend. And that will create tension on one side and compression on the other side. And that's how that column fails. For a beam, same thing. When you put the load on stronger and stronger and stronger, it wants to bend. When it bends, it gets tension at the bottom, compression at the top, and that's how it fails. So we make these frame structures, and again, use materials that are good in tension and compression to resist them. At the beginning here, we're going to be looking at ancient castles in Japan. These are huge, massive structures and because very different from the Hittites in central Turkey, where there were no trees. In Japan, there are jillions of trees. Their islands are just covered with forests. And so the daimyos, or ancient warlords in Japan, they were all trying to one-up each other by building these bigger and more incredible castles. And so they're taking forests and they're using these big pieces of wood to make these frames that are columns and beams. And that's how they're constructing the whole character of the castle up there like that. And that's what it looks like on the inside. These are massive, huge pieces of wood. They've got compressive structure at the bottom. But what they really thought was magnificent looking was not the stone, but the ability of the wood to do these big cantilevers. The cantilever, of course, is in bending too. It wants to bend like this. So the wood is there to resist that bending, and these big, deep eaves and cantilevers were a very exciting kind of thing for them. So again, we have the frame technology beginning to generate architectural form. This is presumably the largest wood structure ever built in the world. It's Todaiji Temple in Nara in Japan. So this is comparable to the Pantheon or Hagia Sophia, a very magnificent major public building in Japan. And it's being made out of this frame structure and using the wood that was so abundant there. But now the pieces of wood are enormous. So there you see a person and the size of those columns. They're tree trunk size, like redwood tree trunk size, inside and outside the building. These massive collections of boards that they've made out of these heavy, heavy, huge timbers to make enormous spans, magnificent spans in this big public building. And then elsewhere, you can see the drama of these cantilevers, these light wooden things that can be in bending and can defy gravity. And, you know, again, it's shaping the character of that pagoda, is the fact that it's really reveling in what wood can do and what the structural loads can do when you're in bending. And then the sort of small-scale articulation, just like we were seeing in that town hall in Northeastern, where the shape of that arch and the capital and the shaft and the base, all of those things are really talking about how loads are transferred. So all the framing here, where you see the ridge beam at the top, and you see that transferred via the squinch to a truss, and that truss standing over the space here, all of the architectural form and articulation is really about loads, how loads are transferred, how bending works, and that's making the character of the building. Now, it's very interesting that at a certain point in Japan, they were using these big timbers. They seem to have an infinite supply of them. Unfortunately, sometimes, because timber can burn, sometimes they would have fires in their cities, and it would destroy the city. And that didn't seem to faze them. They came back and rebuilt the city again. And they did this over and over. But in the late 19th century, there was a fire in Edo, which is now Tokyo, and it destroyed a substantial part of the city. And they went out to try to find the timbers to rebuild this, and they realized they were running out of timber. There seemed to be an infinite supply of wood, but as Japanese population was growing, as the cities were growing, they were beginning to have a short supply of timber. And so they addressed that very thoroughly, very ecologically, of saying, okay, we're going to conserve the timber. So they began to distribute. If you were a certain kind of person, you're going to build a certain kind of house, you could only get so much timber. That's all you could have. Figure out how to use it as best you can. The big warlords, nope, you couldn't build a big badass castle like that anymore. You only have so much timber that you can use. So the challenge began to be, how can I make the most of the limited resource I have of wood. How could I use that wood just as efficiently as I possibly could to get the maximum bang for the least amount of investment of material? So they're looking around, and they also were then farming wood and getting better at making the production side as efficient as it could be. And it began to really make a new aesthetic in Japanese architecture. And frankly, now it's an aesthetic that we find extremely beautiful, but it really came out of a combination of structure and materials generating architectural form, and also the lack of supply of those materials, the conservation of those resources to use them as efficiently as possible. So now we begin to get an aesthetic that is not big, heavy timbers. It's much smaller pieces of wood used in a much more efficient way. And the frame, very spare and very elegant here. Also making buildings that were very open. That frame was really the essence of the building. And then the infill was not solid. And in this case, they invented the shoji screen, which was a really wonderful way of making essentially wood into paper. And they're making these very, very thin walls that are made out of paper, made out of wood, but a different form. And those then would slide and open. And they created a whole spatial quality of the architecture, a connection of indoors and outdoors in the architecture that, of course, would have been impossible in a masonry building, but is possible in a frame building. And especially as you make that frame as elegant and thin and delicate as you possibly can, and begin then to connect with gardens. And they begin to make the garden design as important as the interior design of the house, and to integrate the interiors and the exteriors in a very elaborate way. And out of that comes a whole aesthetic of Japanese architecture that is very beautiful, very serene, and very spare and elegant. But in fact, it's all based in structure and materials, and even a very resource-efficient utilization of the materials available to them at the time. So again, this is bending materials being used as a provocation for architectural character. Now, that's true all over the world. So on the right, this is like Shakespeare's house in Stratford-upon-Avon. And you can see the half timbering, which really is the frame, the wood frame of that building. On the left, you can see an American, typical American house of colonial era. And again, they're using timber, and they're using it as a frame, and they're using it in bending. And that shapes the form and character of the American farmhouse made out of wood in that way. And it also shapes the character of bigger buildings. So on the right, we see a steel frame, and high-rise buildings often are very explicit in their expression of the construction of that frame. On the left, we see a reinforced concrete frame where they're ghosting away there the reinforcing bars, and then you can see it covered with the concrete. But the shapes and forms as it goes from the beam into the column, all of that is shaped in a way that expresses the structural character of what's going on in that bending system. So we can see that in 20th century American houses. This is a very beautiful house just outside of Boston, the Strimling House by Morris Smith. And it's very explicitly a frame. It's a wood frame house. It's clad in wood boards, but you can see the columns and beams and structural elements inside and outside the house. You even see that in things like bookshelves and light fixtures. Everything in the house is really reveling in that frame, that bending structure that is shaping all the pieces and parts. So that shelf on the right, that buffet, is really just looking at, like, how do you span, how do you support, how do all those elements express themselves. A really extraordinary example of this is the Lakeshore Drive Apartments by Mies van der Rohe. Again, we've looked at Mies examples of his work before from the very beginning of the class. In this case, it's a high-rise residential building. He makes this very, very rigorous frame of columns and beams. And you can see it in the slide on the left, those even square bays in both of the two buildings. Sorry, my red light is not very bright here. But you can see that frame as it's ticking along there in both directions, perfectly square bays. That is giving the kind of rigor and grid and order for the building. And then all of the apartments are planned around that module and that grid of the structural frame. Then on the exterior of the building, you can see those major elements of the frame and then minor elements between them. All of the proportions, all of the articulation of the building is really a subdivision of that structural frame as it's expressed in the building. Now, the truth is, that's actually what steel columns and beams look like when they go together, or did when this was being built. And you see the rivets and the reinforcing plates carrying the loads of the beam into the column. He didn't express all of that, but he basically does still show you the frame and show you those vertical and horizontal elements that are making the bending structure. That again allows him to totally open up the interiors. You get floor-to-ceiling glass. The whole experience of that high-rise building, that, you know, cool, urban, you know, out there feeling, it's all because of this frame. You couldn't have floor-to-ceiling glass. You couldn't have that sense of openness. You couldn't have that big connection to the sky if it weren't for that very thin, elegant steel frame that's enabling you to build this tall building with very, very little structural mass. Maybe the ultimate in a steel frame is the John Deere headquarters in Moline, Illinois. This is again by Earl Cernan. And in this case, this is a corporate headquarters in a very, very beautiful natural setting. So the idea is when you're inside that building working at your desk, you want to see just as much of that exterior as possible. So it's very important to have the least kind of frame there that would allow you to have those big, unobstructed views. On the other hand, we do have some sun control issues here. So he wanted to have good sun shading in the building. So that's got some horizontal and vertical articulation to control the sun. And all of that is done in steel, and almost like it's Tinker Toys. You see it just as elemental as it can be, columns and beams. Now we even have passing connections, so we see the individual integrity of each element. Massive columns, the big girders that go across, the beams that go in the other direction, the purlins that go the counter direction, all of the sunshading, all of the handrails, all of those in perfectly sized steel to do the spanning job that they need to do. And the collection of all of that then is a building that has this rhythm, that has this delicacy that gives it its architectural character. In this case, the steel is what we call Core 10 steel. It's a steel that normally you worry about steel rusting, and you would paint steel to keep it from rusting. But this is a kind of steel where the rust itself, it forms a layer of rust on the outside of the steel, and then that makes it impervious to any more rusting. So he's even gone back to make the steel as steel-like, no paint on it, just the kind of rusty finish on it that makes it look very, very authentic and natural in the woods of Illinois there. And then, of course, on the inside, you get these big open views out to the landscape. You're in your office, you look out to the green and trees, and the natural environment, the long views beyond. But all of that, interior and exterior, the whole experience of the building, very much shaped and formed by the structure, the loads, the bending quality that's there in that building. Now, This again, in an earlier lecture, we talked about Frank Lloyd Wright and the fact that you could look at this falling water project in Pennsylvania, and at the very same time, his Taliesin West project in Arizona. And you could look at those two buildings, and you would hardly know they were by the same architect, because he wasn't doing things in a Frank Lloyd Wright style. What he was doing was he was responding to the landscape of Pennsylvania or the landscape of Arizona, and the building was coming out of there. In this case, we've got two buildings by Errol Sarnan. On the right there is Morrison Stiles College. On the left is John Deere headquarters. On the right here, John Deere headquarters. On the right here, Morrison Stiles College. I make the same argument again that I don't think you'd know those were done by the same architect. Because Errol Sarnan isn't designing buildings that are in some kind of Errol Sarnan style. What Errol Sarnan is doing is understanding, in the case of those dormitories at Yale, I'm on a masonry campus. We've got all these massive neo-Gothic buildings. I'm going to make a building out of masonry materials. That means it's going to be a compressive structure. What does a compressive structure tell me about the shape or character of that building? And the building emerges out of those constraints that were there in that problem, the reality of that problem. In the very same way, then, in Moline, Illinois, on the left there, he's got an office building and a beautiful park-like environment. He wants just as much visibility of the outdoors as possible. And he says, well, I need a frame. I don't want to do a masonry structure here. That'd be ridiculous. So I find a technology that's appropriate. And then he uses that technology in a very explicit and elegant way. He understands it completely. And that shapes a completely different kind of architecture. And in the end, it isn't about Errol Sarnan style. It's about making buildings that are appropriate to their place and their technology. Okay, so Twitter card question for today. So I want you to think through both these frame buildings we looked at and the bearing buildings that we looked at, the compressive structures and the bending structures. And I want you to answer that question I was posing earlier. Is it important? Is it better if a building's aesthetic is rooted in some kind of technology, some kind of authentic expression of the way that building is built? Is this an enhancement of the building's aesthetic? And so again, if you could use a scale of 1 to 10, where at 10, yes, I think these kind of technological enhancements make a building more aesthetically beautiful, and I think it's important that it has that kind of authenticity. Or 1 would be, no, these are completely separate issues. Yeah, the building should stand up, but honestly, that doesn't have to have anything to do with what it looks like or its expression. How important is technology as an element in the aesthetic expression of a building?